episode 58 of the Art Scene Podcast. After a long hiatus, I'm back at it again, speaking with various artists and art makers here in the Bay Area, an artist and printmaker based out of Oakland. I visited Drew at his home-based print studio to talk about Sunlight Editions, the former print publishing house he used to run with his former printing partner, Yoni Osega, and his current publishing project he recently founded on his own called 222 Press. We also talked about how Drew even became interested in printmaking itself. It was an all-around great conversation about the world of printing and the work that goes into publishing work for artists, so I hope you enjoyed as much as I did. Before I play our conversation, here are some events in the Bay to check out. First, over at Part 2 Gallery, there are two solo shows up through December 14th. The first is for Yanming Lee Thorpe, titled Prologue Freer Than the Wind. And the second is for Shannon Rogers, titled Time Machine. Then, on December 5th, from 1 to 8 p.m. at SF MoMA, there will be a small press book bazaar featuring local presses, zine publishers, artists, and more. It's a great place to shop for Christmas gifts this year. Admission will be free since it will be the first Thursday when museums are free to the Bay Area residents. And while you're there, be sure to check out the two major exhibitions currently on view. The first one is called Get in the Game, Sports, Art, and Culture, a show about how athleticism and competition completely shaped and influenced contemporary art and design. And the second is Amy Sherald, America Sublime, the largest presentation of Sherald's work to date. All right, now here's my conversation with Drew. I've been looking forward to doing this for a while, as you know. I've been wanting to do this since you and Yoni were doing Sunlight Editions, actually, like pre-pandemic.
I
mentioned to you before, I'm a big fan of like works on paper, like fine prints. So at my day job, I'm a museum registrar, and most of the time I work with works on paper, and like, you know, I do with paintings and stuff too, but really I prefer to work with like prints and stuff. And a lot of it was my entryway too into the field. Mm-hmm. So I fell in love with like the master prints, and then eventually went to contemporary, and now that's what I'm into. So what was always cool for me when I moved here to the Bay Area was finding out that this is like kind of a hotbed for like a lot of printing presses. Like,
it's packed.
It's packed with them.
And history too.
Big time. I mean, you got Crown Point, you got Paulson Fontaine, you got Magnolia, and those are like the old school, like big ones. But then there's like the small ones, like Tiny Splendor, you got Night Diver, you got Copa Press, and then you got like places like was like Sunlight Editions, which was like these small up and coming ones. So I was like really excited to talk to you guys.
I'm sorry we couldn't make
But you know, it was really funny because I think at the time, yeah. I wish I had reached out a little earlier
I remember Yoni and I talking about it, and then for whatever reason,
we would love to. Bad news is we're closing, we're shutting it down.
Oh, is that what it was?
Yeah.
I wish we had done it then, because I think there would have been, I mean, this will be great too, but I sort of wish there was a document of some of that to kind of have like codified a little bit of what we were doing at the time. I would have been interested to hear it now. I mean, it's been probably 3 years or something since.
Yeah, has it been? Yeah.
I think so.
Wow.
But yeah, that was a super exciting project. And I think 222 is, for me anyways, like taking the parts that interested me personally the most and trying to push it in a more specifically fine art direction, more like kind of something that might end up in the Achenbach. Whereas I think the work that Sunlight was making, not a value judgment on any of the actual work that was created, but I think just the medium of screen printing is more likely to end up, say, in like the SF MoMA art. And like the ephemera and poster stuff, which is maybe an unfair designation, but it just kind of, it is what it is. So moving away from screen printing and into etching and relief, I think it's just more opportunity for the work to be taken seriously and seen. And honestly, it's going to be, it has been like a lot of the same artists that we're kind of like rolling through, just with an opportunity to maybe elevate some of the results is the idea anyways.
Yeah. I'm going to talk to you more about that I'm glad you pointed that out, because I did kind of notice it a little bit. But I wanted to also first start, I guess, with how you even got into this field
And just even going back to, like, how far back did your interest in being in art, like in art making, like mm-hmm. how far back did that go?
I mean, it's forever. My mom was a art history major in college. My dad's an architect. So the like art, my house, the house I grew up in is like full of art books. My dad basically built the house I grew up in. It was like under construction forever. So there was like a creative element there that was kind of always in it. And, you know, this was back in the 90s when he was like hand drafting things.
Yeah.
So like, I remember making him make little models, and it's all very like a lot of line drawing stuff, which kind of comes back into, you know, etching. It's a lot of precision and fine detail. So I think that stuff has kind of always been in there. And then I'm from Santa Cruz, so it was like skate graphics and surf graphics. And the guys doing that, really the guy, Jim Phillips, who did like the Screaming Hand and the Santa Cruz logo and stuff, he basically designed the look of that whole town. So there was like a very heavy graphic arts just like seed in my consciousness since forever. And I had a teacher in high school named Frank Wessels, who I think was a print major at San Jose State, and so had presses in like our high school art class.
Oh, wow.
Public school.
Yeah.
Which was, I think they all belonged to him personally. Like it was, we were, it was not a very well-funded school, but for whatever reason, this guy was running like a really cool thing. So I did my first etching probably at like 15.
Wow.
Where he kind of pulled me aside and was just like, here's your little thing for the day. So it's kind of been since then.
Yeah, so you've been exposed to printmaking for like for early on then, for a long time. Like not, it wasn't like just something you came upon in grad school or something. It's like since high school, it sounds like. Yeah.
When I was, I have the first, in one of these drawers, I have the first print I ever made, which was just like a linoleum cut, which is funny because I've kind of gone all the way back around, and now I like, you know, there's a stack of linoleum prints right there. So, yeah, it really has been that long. And then when I went to SVI, it turned out to be, I mean, it was like a mess kind of, as we both know, but their print department was really strong.
Yeah.
And my specific cohort was like just packed with people. I got really lucky.
Yeah. What's a deep history of that print department? Totally. Yeah.
And I was there for like kind of the perfect time. It felt like Tim Berry was there. I got Paul Maloney's 2 years. And he introduced a lot of, not that Tim wasn't doing that, but Paul introduced a lot of really kind of high level etching and intaglio techniques to a department that kind of like was ready for it and full of people. But, you know, it was a special thing to be there for those two guys. And then Art Hazelwood, who was kind of less interested in the technical side of things maybe, but interested in how you could use print politically, socially, you know, and creatively.
And, coming out of high school, were you just like adamant that you're like, I'm going to art school, like this is like what I'm going to do? Like, or was it full on like parent support of this? This is what I'm going to do. This is great. Like this kid's got a future in it.
I think I was probably a difficult kid. I definitely was a very difficult kid. And I think the fact that I had any direction, they were like excited to support. So I was very lucky to have them support the idea for art school. But I think they were just like, thank God he wants to do anything.
Yeah.
So I showed up to SFAI as a, really because they gave me the most money, I think. I had gotten into like SAIC and maybe something in Seattle and whatever, but SFAI was giving out like merit scholarships at the time kind of for no reason. Like I remember my parents thinking it was really funny that I got an academic merit-based scholarship. Like, is this a real school? So I showed up as a painter, though, but I think it was really just for lack of sort of knowing how those mediums were going to be kind of chopped up at art school. And I did maybe a year or two. It was probably like a semester and a half, or a year and a semester in the painting department, and really was just not very good at it.
Yeah.
Didn't like it. And I found out that everybody who was really drawing was up in the print department. and I've met like all these incredible people immediately, and teachers like Juan Fuentes was my first teacher there. He's a relief artist who's been here forever, and I immediately just like switched everything over.
Wow.
Like basically after one class. Yeah. And then it's been like that ever since. I met Yoni probably the first year, you know. David Tim showed up a couple years after that. Juan Solis, who's back in LA now, but he's doing incredible like tattooing and mural work. I met my wife, Nelly. Like there was just so many people doing who've gone on to do really amazing things, just packed into this little like 3 year period.
Yeah. And this was for undergrad, or this is undergrad or grad school.
Yeah, I only have a BFA. I don't have a BFA.
You know, that was for your BFA, right? This yeah. So like, I mean, it's crazy because I think, you know, it's gone now, the school. But I mean, for a mess that it was, I think what's underestimated about SFAI and its history is that the amount of art skills that they provided from at a BFA level, mm-hmm. even at an MFA level, I think are pretty amazing. Like, I mean, everybody, yeah. even if you're a BFA, even like you came out of that, like whatever medium or whatever mm-hmm. specialty came out of, were a lot of skills. Like a lot of like you knew how to paint, you knew how to like go with it, and then be on your own with it. Like yeah. It was pretty impressive. Like the staff that they had in terms of the teachers, like totally. That teachers really made the school. If anything,
I think they really underestimated, or they. It was always kind of the disconnect. It's like right. SFAI's strength is like. It was not that Chestnut is worth however many millions of dollars, you know, and I think they kind of operated that way. But
right.
it's like, you guys are at the dead center of whatever San Francisco, like, art scene and history thing. Everybody's just, like, slowly being pulled into this place. And you get these incredible teachers, and the students show up kind of without even knowing why they're there totally.
Yeah.
But we got just, like, you know, such an incredible cohort out of it. And... yeah, it sucks
yeah.
that it's gone.
Yeah, because I think people really forget that the same teachers that were teaching the MFA kids are the same ones teaching the BFA kids. So if mm-hmm. if you think about it, they're all getting the same type of education at yeah. one point or another. I mean, and they really are. And
all you had to do was like show a little bit of interest and you were getting the MFA quality stuff.
Basically.
Like I know Tim Berry was kind of back and forth all the time. And, you know, Nicole Archer, she wasn't dumbing it down.
No, she was hardcore. No, yeah. I mean, I took one... funny enough, I took one BFA class mm-hmm. Because it was like an extracurricular requirement that I needed to take, but it was the history of print.
Was it the history of print? We might have been in that class.
Maybe. Today. Was that the one where Ed Hardy visited?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, maybe we were in the same class. So we were in the same class. Yeah, and that was funny because, and maybe you do remember this because she called us out in it, because there was maybe four of us that were grad students in that class, mm-hmm. and... she assigned us all a paper, but she had higher standards for the four grad students, and she was mad that our paper was like not better than everybody else's in the class. And she called us out like in the class in front of everybody and was like, I am disappointed that your paper is like, I expect this out of the undergrads, but not you guys. And I'm going to make you write the paper again.
Oh, no.
And it was like, and I'm sitting there like, what? And like, and she was like, just because this is a BFA class, do not be mistaken that I do not have like higher standards or whatever. And it was really interesting. But at that point, it was when I realized like, okay, like she's for real. Like she has high standards for everybody in this. Like she mm-hmm. wanted us all writing at the same level. Which also got me thinking like, oh man, there was like a BFA kid in this class that was like writing probably at a grad school, wasn't mailing it in and was writing at
I don't think it was me. That
probably. No, but it was really interesting. But it, you know, it showed how much she cared.
Yeah, totally.
But yeah. All right. So then you come out of SFAI mm-hmm. is like when you come out of that, like is now you're fully, I mean, so you meet Yoni there, right?
Yeah.
And so, and Yoni, who ends up being your partner in doing Sunlight Editions, like, mm-hmm. was that when you guys are formulating the idea or concept that, like, maybe we want to do something like this? Or?
Not at all. It was, I think, so we didn't start Sunlight until, 2019.
So it's a few more years
before,
there
was, like, 4 or 5 years in there where I immediately went and got a job at a screen printing shop, which my entire time at SFAI, I was like, screen printing's not real. I don't want to do it. It's not, you know, I was very like, I want to do the fine art stuff. And the screen printing there was like really great teachers that I honestly missed and then met later. Like Nat Swope was running the screen printing thing there, and he's like incredible. You know, he's like one of the best printers in the Bay. Really, really smart dude that I should have learned a lot from, and I just wasn't taking those classes. But I turned around and got a job immediately out of school at a screen printing shop on San Pablo over here called Forthright, that was run, still is run, by a guy named Connor Ottenweller, who was a CCAC grad. And he, it was, I think it was his like senior project or something, was to start this screen shop. And it was like a tiny little punk rock thing with a gallery up front. We were just like printing t-shirts and posters in the back. And I was there for maybe 3 years. And I had gone and bought a little like etching proofing press in LA and drove it back in my like Honda Civic and like almost, you know, killed it. But I was printing in my room doing relief prints for people and like publishing, air quotes, like little editions and doing stuff like that. And then I think Yoni and I at some point, because we were both living in the neighborhood over here, he was like kind of on Campbell and I was on Center, which ended up being just blocks away from where Sunlight was.
Yeah. You're talking about in Oakland, right? So you've always been based here in Oakland.
We were all kind of like down in the lower bottoms there. And we found a garage. I think Junebug actually called us at one point and just said, like, I met a guy who's cleaning out a warehouse space. You should go look at it. And we jumped on it, and there was six of us initially, I think. And Sunlight was downstairs, and then Colton Callahan, another SFAI painter, was down with us. Chris Birch, who's still painting murals and stuff, is was upstairs. Junebug and David Tim, I think, was the original six. And we were there for, I think it was like 3 years. Closed it in 2022, something like that, like early 2022. But even I think when we got the place, I don't think that we had fully decided that we were going to like publish prints necessarily together.
Yeah, what was the goal? Like, so like when you're coming up with that idea, like, because you guys were partnering up with artists, which, by the way, so now we're going to get into the part where you're talking, because the difference between the two, because the thing I think I noticed with Sunlight was, which is a difference I'm noticing with the current press that you have now, is that with Sunlight editions, it felt like, and like it was always accompanying a show they were doing or accompanying some project that they were doing, right? Like it was like a print that was like, but then it was like in that it was like going to be presented at a show that they're at or something. Like it was always like in a side project in addition to something else that they were doing. It felt like all the time, but it felt like that sometimes. So I was curious.
It was a intentional marketing strategy.
That's it.
Kind of.
Yeah.
Which, you know, we didn't really know what we were doing. We totally stumbled in. I mean, we did have the plan, like, we're going to rent this space out. We're going to get a bunch of screen printing equipment. We know how to do this. We can, like, screen printing lends itself to some commercial jobs. So you can just do those on the side, not tell anyone. And that pays for the publishing.
Yeah.
You know, and it's less pressure on the artists. It's less pressure on the publishing program that we're running. So that was definitely part of the plan. And then we were kind of just bringing in our friends. Like Muse was having a show at Part 2. And I think maybe it was Brock or something was like, hey, make something to accompany this. And I remember going in and being like, we're going to make something. It has to be different. It has to stand on its own. It's going to be like four colors. We're going to make him a print that kind of accompanies the thing. And maybe it's easier to sell that way, but it'll stand on its own. And because it was like our first print, I remember walking out of his studio and being like, damn, how did we agree to like a 22 color reproduction of a painting? Like, what the fuck just happened in there? there was a tension there kind of the whole time where it was like people go, oh, you're making screen prints. Can you make a screen print of this painting?
Yeah.
And it lends itself to reproduction because it's too malleable.
Yeah.
You know, you can do too many things with it. And to make original screen prints sometimes feels like if you're going to all that effort, why not just make a relief print or right. etching? You know, it's a difficult medium for that stuff.
Sure.
So to make flat stock and not have it just be a poster is tough. And some of them totally do. Like, I think one of the best prints that we made there that I still have tucked up somewhere in here was Yetunde Olukbaju's print, where we did like a straight up CMYK mm-hmm. that was, you know, of a piece that didn't exist. This was like original work that we were making. And then they were painting in Van Dyke fluid, and we were shooting photos in our screen printing darkroom onto the prints. So all the prints had like these additional kind of embellishments in them that were done kind of using the materials, but not in a way that you would do in a commercial screen printing shop.
Yeah.
So there was ways to do it, but oftentimes it ended up getting sort of sucked into kind of ephemera.
Yeah.
For other shows or events that people were doing. And that's a tricky line to walk, because you don't want to feel like you're just educating people every time they ask you for something. Hey, I've got a show coming up. Can we make some prints? Here's the painting I want to have done. And then you have to be like, no, you have to come in. You have to work with us. We decided after like 18 months that it had to be original work.
Yeah.
But it's a trick to kind of pull that stuff out and make the artist and the collector and the gallery sort of understand that thing. And that's just kind of a lot of work.
Yeah.
To like fight for the respect of a medium that, you know, you're trying to make it something that's not.
Yeah.
Sort of.
Yeah.
Does that answer your question?
No, no, for sure. No, I mean, no, it's like, it's kind of interesting because like it feels like Sunlight was just something that like organically just popped up and happened. And then you guys just kind of went with it, and then mm-hmm. things just came. It just came, like the jobs just came, right? And it's what it felt like, because you had all these connections and friends who knew you had this space yeah. and the ability to do this printing. And then you took the project because they were interesting, they were fun, you mm-hmm. were doing it. But it felt, what I get from you, mm-hmm. like you in particular, only seeing from your perspective,
yeah,
only,
yeah.
not the rest of the group, was that it felt like it was like chaotic. Fun at times, but in a good way.
Yeah.
But like in a very like stressful, like boom, 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 it's coming. Like we, you know, like, but whereas 222 Press is more like, now you're running it, you have a vision, and it's you're going to be able, it's not going to come at you in that same way, right? Like it's not, the project's not going to come at you in a way of, hey, I heard you have this space. No, yeah. Now it's you, like in a very more planned out, more strategic way, going and reaching out with people. I would like to do a collaboration.
It's
going
to be very slow. And I don't mean to, and I mean, you're right, to, this is my version of it. Yoni, I'm sure, has a different version. Yeah. I think I can almost guarantee that he would say it was like more planned out than I'm making it seem.
what do they say? Like sometimes, like some people, I mean, it's like different ways of planning, because sometimes yeah. people like that sort of style of working mm-hmm. and it works. Sometimes it works. Like,
yeah.
And, you know, I hear sometimes about, you know, like, you know, Crown Point Press was like that at one point earlier on. And,
totally.
And I mean, yeah. look how long they've existed, you yeah. know. It's just different. Like, different yeah. places work differently. But it sounds like that's the vibe I get from Sunlight Editions in terms of, like...
It was, like, very exciting for
exactly,
that. And it
yeah.
was something that, like, there was sort of a lightning in a bottle element to it that was, you know, really cool.
Yeah.
You know, and it's something that, like, 222 isn't.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to be very, very slow here.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, and you kind of see that, too, in the works that you guys were making out of Sunlight. Mm-hmm. All the stuff that you guys were making were very, boom, like, wow. Like, it was very mm-hmm. exciting, very in your face, just, like, a lot of prizing. This is exciting. Like, I want mm-hmm. that print. You know, it was like, yeah. you know, on demand, I want that. Like, as soon as you saw it on Instagram, and every time I remember being like, sold out already. Like, it's been like 3 hours.
Well, I think it was, I mean, that is totally due to the artist.
Yeah.
You know,
for
so,
sure.
And that was something that we were kind of just lucky to be right here. And then I think a really large part of the story, too, is that we were a Black-owned business in Oakland around the time of George Floyd. We had been around for maybe a year when that happened. And there was a kind of confluence of events there that really, it was an opportunity for the artists involved and for us to kind of I don't know, shine a light on people who deserved to be seen and for whatever reason, not for whatever reason, for a very specific reason, people were taking the time to highlight Black-owned businesses, and we were there for that. And it was, I mean, I think that is like a really important part of it that should not go. It was not just a totally casual, wild thing. It was, we had a mostly Black program, and the world, like, it was just a timing thing.
Yeah.
And it was like the right time for that program, I think. And it was an honor. Like, it was so exciting for me. It was the most rewarding, like, creative endeavor that I've ever had, was to be able to just be hands, you know, and help make the work and help release it and help, and just to like be in the room and watch that kind of energy was incredible, you know. So to have all of these artists come in, most of whom were in the Black Male Collective, mm-hmm. which was kind of what it was. An Ace, I think Ace and Yetunde started it, and then I introduced Ace to Yoni when we were still at SFAI, and he had already met Musée, and kind of, there was all these people, Junebug and Chris Birch, and you know, they were doing like a really amazing, important thing at the time, and Sun Knight was really there to just kind of like help, honestly, like commercialize some of it. We were just a way for people to access those artists who were already doing their own thing. So
yeah.
Sun Knight like really benefited from that kind of thing.
I'm glad also too, I think, that you guys were able to, before, because eventually, as you mentioned, eventually it shut down, right? Mm-hmm. But what was cool is before you shut down, you got to do, was it an incline gallery that you guys got to do?
That was actually after we shut down.
Well, yeah, no, it was like right after. It was like the very last thing you guys were able to do a show of like every print that you guys had published, or which was really cool, because I think for me, as you mentioned, like, you used the phrase flash in the pan. I didn't realize either how much of a flash in the pan it was, because that was such a crazy 2-year period too, of the pandemic and everything. You're talking Black Lives Matter, everything that was going on. And I remember those prints were coming out one by one, boom, boom, boom. They were just coming out
too fast.
Yeah, yeah. But they're, you know, but like, and you know, and they were exciting. And then then once Sun Knight Edition shut down, and then you had that show. And then to see them all together, and then to realize in retrospect, I was like, oh man, they had done a lot. And to see them all together side by side, and to see how different they all were from one another, and how also towards the end, like how much the work had, like the quality of it was just like amazing, like from beginning to end, and only gotten better, like, which is even crazier. Cool to see.
Yes, thank you. I appreciate that. I really am, like, I'm super, super proud of it. And I think there's enough distance from that end now that I'm kind of, I get to just be like, yeah, that was really cool that we did that.
Yeah.
But in the moment, it was, like, you know, really exciting. But it also felt like a tremendous amount of responsibility.
Yeah.
Too, because we were, like, in the beginning, we were really just, like, you know, yelling upstairs, like, Junebug, you want to make a print? You know, you know, can you come down here and, like, do some stuff?
Yeah.
And by the end, we felt like, oh, we've sort of been, like, you know, like, SF MoMA was reaching out, and we were kind of, you know, New York, but real MoMA.
Yeah.
You know, adult MoMA had, like, reached out and tried to, like, bring us out for something. And it was becoming, like, oh, we can't just work with our friends. We need to, like, take this seriously in a way that maybe we weren't before, and we were getting pulled in a lot of different directions, and there was some, like, just at the end of the day, the publishing thing only ever broke even, and
it's a lot of work.
You still have to come in on your off days and print fucking wedding invitations and shit,
right,
and business cards, you know. So there was, like, you're running a screen printing business and, like, kind of on the side an art handling business, where, and then you're, like, doing this thing, and to organize all of those things and make sure that everybody's...
Well, and like everybody else too, like, still in some way had day jobs too, in addition, right? Like, jobs.
Totally.
Like, not, this is, wasn't like their only thing in their lives, right?
Yeah, which I think is smart, because it allows you the creative freedom to... I mean, it's unfortunate, but it means that you can do what you want. We didn't have to make purely financial decisions there. Because if we had made purely financial decisions, we wouldn't have been able to work with people who we thought deserved it, but we're like, oh, we're not sure if it's going to sell, but that wasn't like the point, you know?
Right, right.
And it's still not here. Like that kind of freedom from like making total financial sense is kind of important.
Yeah.
It's really important.
Yeah. I think that's important to point out though too, right? Where like it's never that easy as like, yeah, we became popular. Yeah, we're on demand, but it's not that easy to just accept every single offer and whatever, because unless they're giving you immediately, like, we're immediately going to give you all a salary of $1 million a year, like, that will forever pay your bills, like, you know, or, you know, steady income, it's not it's not the, like, answer to all your problems. Like, you still all have to hustle and do all this, like, you have to consider all the stresses, the other stresses that come with it.
Right? A lot of these opportunities, too, are, like, you want to spend a ton of money up front and like we'll pay you back for some of it. And it'll
be some commission dollars out of a contract.
You sit through a million hours of Zoom calls. And, you know, like we did a big thing for SF MoMA, but they didn't want to use any of the artists we were already working with. They wanted us to work with people who will remain nameless, whatever.
Yeah, some other artists that they wanted to dictate.
Exactly. But, and it's like, well, we don't have a relationship with these people. And it was like, fine, you know, it all went okay, but it was just like extra stress for it was like a marketing opportunity for the Sun Knight letterhead and the SF MoMA letterhead to be on the same thing. We did it a few times, and like people there were like very nice to us. It was all cool, but it's not free money.
Right.
You're working for it, and while you're doing that, we didn't have employees.
Right.
So we weren't publishing the other stuff from the other artists in the program who, you know, were kind of up next. It was, you know, that stuff, and it really pulls you in a lot of different directions, and ultimately being self-employed is just like wild.
Yeah,
you know, it's really hard. It's not for everybody.
So Sun Knight Editions ends. Mm-hmm. How far afterwards, or how long afterwards, are you? All right, I'm ready to start the next project. And it ends up being 222 Press.
Immediately. I didn't stop.
Like, so you because you love this, like, no matter what, like, this is like, you love having a press, like, you love making and collaborating with artists, like, and making work.
Yeah, totally.
And so what was your process with that? Like, we're like in starting, like, having to start again, but then this time you're on your own, right? I'm assuming it's just you at this point.
Yeah, it was honestly like a fucking nightmare. It was really hard for a little bit, but just financially, because I kept the space.
Yeah.
And I had it almost on my own for like 9 months or something, which was like, financially, I just like was fucked. So I just had a garage with like a tiny little press and like could barely use it because I just had to work all the time. It was like ridiculous. And then I met a couple of people who were etchers, and they moved in and built like a really beautiful shop and took over a bunch of the rent. And we were able to kind of juggle it for a few years. And that it was always the plan that I would kind of like pass it off to them, but I was going to use all the stuff while it was there and basically use that as like a resetting period. And I mean, while I was there, I guess it ended up being more like 18 months, but made the initial series with Ryan Whalen, who really has been like instrumental in restarting this thing and like coming up with the idea. Ryan and his wife Liz, who I also saw on your I listened to the first part of it.
Yeah, she's great.
So they really were like huge, huge boosters in kind of restarting everything. So a bunch of that work was made, you know, at the old Sun Knight shop on Wood Street. And now been here for like 2 months now. So this is like brand new.
So this is brand new, this place.
And made really the first edition. It's right there, the Lanny Geyer ones.
So let's talk about the philosophy of this place, which you've kind of touched on already. So the philosophy of this place is what, like, now? Like, what is your goal with this place?
So, I mean, a lot of it was framed as like a reaction to things that I thought went wrong with Sun Knight, which was, it was too fast. It was not as carefully curated maybe as it should have been towards the end, like that kind of responsibility to kind of craft a cohesive kind of body of work, I think is really important. Not that everything has to do it, so that's not even something Sun Knight did wrong. It was just, it feels like this can be more of a curatorial project as well.
Yeah, you seem to be very conscientious of that. Like, where does that come from?
Fussy is all I don't know. I don't know. I mean,
who do you think of in terms of in the art world about when you think about that? Like, in terms of like, who do you look up to?
I mean, really, the guy, the Buddha who I'm, you know, modeling kind of just this model after is Jacob Samuel. It's a printer down in L.A. He did. He just retired, but he had this press called, it's called like Jacob Samuel Edition, and one man shop, small, one color, oftentimes like simple stuff, making etchings usually. And he came from this tradition of kind of like West Coast print that I think a lot of it comes from Crown Point, but it's like very technical, big, lots of plates, kind of this like 80s abstract expressionist craziness. And it takes all of the technique and skill in the world to make those things. And ultimately, I don't want to live with any of it. And I think he was kind of on the same thing. And he took this like incredible technical skill and was like, everything's small. This is the advantage that print has.
Yeah.
Is you can get to the root of somebody's drawing practice or painting practice or sculpture practice. It's like you can take this, the first node of an idea, and then you can kind of, instead of, you know, plowing straight ahead into the painting, you can take this little left turn and turn that initial kernel into something that is, you know, finished piece in its own right that oftentimes lets me see the, you know, it lets you see the genesis of that idea just in like a different light.
Yeah.
And I think it's really apparent in the series I did with Ryan Whalen for his show at Part Two, where I'm looking at like the initial shapes of his drawings, and then you can see those things turn into sculptures in the front room. You know, and yeah, I mean, I think that's kind of smaller, slower, careful, considered.
It's efficient.
Efficient.
You're like the architect's son, basically.
Well, it's funny. I was thinking about it like earlier today. He is a one-man shop that he like operated out of a bedroom in our house.
Yeah.
And he did it for 20 years.
Yeah.
And I just today was like, oh,
yeah, it's
shit.
Like, what you're doing like, now. Look at that.
What the fuck happened?
Yeah. No, yeah.
So it is kind of that. And
it's also like in itself creative because when you have to, when you are like trying to work from home or mm-hmm. like have the both together, right? It does require some sort of creativity to be that efficient in this small space, right? Like this limited space that you mm-hmm. have, but to accomplish what you need to do, right? Like both for your dad. With Jacob Samuel and you,
yeah.
right? Like, I mean, it just sounds like that's being a full circle. This is like an artist, the mind of an artist, yeah. right? At the end of the day, like different techniques, but.
Yeah. I think about it with, you know, I've thought about like the relationship that screen printing has to like the fine art world
mm-hmm.
and what it means to like why there's this hierarchy, you know? And
yeah.
part of me is like, it's all made up, but everything's made up, you know, it's there for a reason.
Yeah.
So the kind of like etching and litho and then relief down here and then a little lower than that is screen printing and then below yeah. that is rezo. Like, is it kind of ridiculous? Yes. Is there also like kind of maybe some concrete practical reasons why those things are more expensive? Totally.
Yeah.
And there's something about offering etching, really, which is, and relief. But doing it in a really specifically limited way. Because screen printing is kind of like, hey, we can do anything, but we can only do it this good. We can print your photos,
yeah,
but they'll look like screen prints. And this is like, I don't know, it's about the limitation. You know, you introduce it to people and you say, we can only go this big, we're not going to do that many plates, it's really going to be on, you know, you to form a relationship with this medium and then let it be the simple thing that it is. And I think that's what excites me.
Yeah.
I mean, I really like it. And it's also like selfishly, it's a way for me to just like insert myself into all these artists' practice that I admire and go like, you know,
well, that's
love this.
That's the collaborative part,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
yeah. Yeah. So then one thing I wanted to point out was the you know, you have a different roster of artists that you've worked with so far that I think are a lot different than the roster of artists that you've worked with in the past. And you've talked about, obviously, why that difference existed. Would you work again with, like, the same, with the previous, with people you've worked with previously? Or are you, like,
yeah,
a type?
Yeah, totally. Some of them. Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Because I'm curious to see what the type of work you could make in this slower method.
Yeah.
With the previous artists that you've worked with, but that when you were just doing screen printing.
Yeah, totally. There's absolutely some people who, like, deserve both. But, I mean, we did, you know, Liz and Ryan, totally. Eric Bender made screen prints with us.
Yeah.
That kind of got shelved for a second, and then he came back and made etchings. I don't have the roster in front of me, but absolutely. Yeah, totally. I think, you know, Muse was always kind of bugging us to, like, oh, you're going to do Aquatint? You're going to do Aquatint? So, you know, if he ever has time, I'd love to have him back, of course. Yeah. You know, there's, yeah, 100%. Because I think a lot of the artists probably would have benefited from less of, like, a crank this one out. And I think what we learned kind of as we were doing that was, like, the second print was always better.
Yeah.
It was, they would come in, they would make their first print, and if it worked and we were going to release it, you know, great. But there was always kind of like a, oh, shit, now I get it. Like, I'll see you guys in a year and we'll come back and try it again. So part of the idea for 222 is to, like, we're putting out the third print.
Yeah.
You know, the first two are, we're doing tests, we're scrapping stuff, we're throwing things in the garbage. You're working here until we have, like, something good. And it's slower, it's more expensive.
Yeah.
And the work is, the artists, I think, are happier with it at the end of the process.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you're hoping too to, like, show too that this is, like, less manufacturing, more of an art making, like an actual art form.
Totally. Yeah, I think so. And it's yeah, whatever. I mean, it's just different.
Yeah,
but I really like the idea of, I don't know, I think about how people are, like, finding art now and what kind of role art actually has in people's day-to-day lives and what the kind of the mechanism of the art market, like that delivery system to people, is good for. And it rewards kind of what Sunlight was doing, which is really, like, make things fast, flashy, it needs to work 2x2 on a screen.
Yeah.
Not that we were intentionally doing that. That was just kind of, it lined up, you know?
Yeah.
And it rewards stuff sometimes that is not, it's not a meritocracy, you know? Right. It's like it's an algorithmic thing. And I think to kind of work, not necessarily, like, against that, I don't want to swim upstream forever, but to try to flush a lot of that stuff out and just make the stuff that's good. You know, like the guy Jacob Samuel, I think he was doing it for like 30 years.
Yeah.
And made 66 editions.
Yeah.
65 editions, something like that. So it was like, it's limited.
Yeah.
The limited thing is important. If you make 1,000 of something, it's not worth anything.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. How, I guess, like, too, so, you know, because I took that class with Nicole Archer in grad school. How much more important to you then is that, where you're, like, trying to limit the additions to preserve that aura of that work, that value, versus, like, the access to the work? Because I think one of the things for me, that one of the reasons why I liked Sunlight Editions too was, you know, because the Muse was, Muse is a perfect example. Muse makes these paintings. They're beautiful paintings, you know. But they're so good, you know. He's now so good. They're out of my price range. I can't ever get one, right? At least not now. God, you know, who knows what the future is if
in
I
a
ever
few
become,
years,
you know,
sure,
maybe. Yeah, who knows? Optimistically. But, you know, like, they're out of my price range. But, you know, I can afford a $100 Sunlight Edition print. That's pretty close. And it's a well done print and a value. And it's signed by Muse. But I know enough about art where it will never become a $30,000 painting or something, or an increase in value. But I know enough that print, because it's still in some way additioned, you know.
Totally, and there's a COA.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. It will have some value to it one day, if I'm a collector too.
I hope so.
Right. But that's more affordable to the person who's a fan of Muse's work. Totally. And so I guess with 222, where if you're going this other route, obviously the more limited. Do you still plan to have, like, I guess, like, because we, you know, you keep mentioning over and over again, the screen printing is, it's very apparent, like, screen printing is at the bottom of this total for you. And
oh, no, there's things below.
Yeah. But, like, you know, I guess it's like, you know, would you ever do screen printing again to have, like, on occasion, these, like, batches, you know, for whether it's marketing or something in a company, in a project, a larger project, where you're like, I have this nice limited print that's the actual legit slow process, and then I'm going to make, like, a series, like, of 100 screen prints that's, like, a version of this, but it's, like, cheaper and more accessible. But because you're doing it, you'll be able to do it your way and at your method. You know what I'm saying? And it's still at your control how that screen print is done.
It's. I'll show you some stuff after, but it's funny that you mention it because I am. Yes, I'm working on a thing right now that with Lanny Geyer and Laura Figa and my wife Nellie and Wayne White is the initial four, but it's going to be a lot longer. It was an idea that Lanny had, and it was to take this portfolio that Parasol Press put out in the 70s, it was like 76 or something like that. And Parasol is like a big, you know, they're like a Crown Point or a Paulson. They put out big, fancy, expensive prints. And then in the 70s, they put out this thing called the rubber stamp portfolio. Have you ever seen this before?
Yeah, I know that one.
So, and it's...
I keep describing it, though.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
It's great.
It's unsigned prints in editions of 1,000.
Yeah.
And it's Tebow and Agnes Martin and Myron Stout, forgetting some, Chuck Close is in it. You know, it's like, it's a big, it's a who's who of kind of, you know, New York in the 70s, whatever. But it was a way for people to own an Agnes Martin kind of sort of that was done in a way that she approved of and... In an edition that's slightly too big, I think.
Yeah.
But still, like, really, you know, accessible. And now, even, you know, 50 years later, with her career kind of being what it was, and, you know, all these people having, you know, having their careers played out, you know, really successfully, you can find them for, like, $500. So it is really accessible still. So Lanny's idea was to reprise that project, but kind of with like a little bit of a twist on it. So that right there is her stack. That's her edition for the rubber stamp portfolio. We're shrinking the editions down from 1,000 to 100. And instead of doing their release schedule was like one print a month for 13 months and then compiling the whole thing at the end. Ours is going to be chopped up into seasons. We're doing winter, spring, summer, and fall. And, like, you know, 4, 5, 6 artists for each one.
Yeah.
And kind of releasing them throughout this next year. So, yes, there'll be, you know, artists. The list isn't totally finalized yet because we kind of have to play with it. But it'll be artists whose work is much more expensive.
Yeah.
Produced here, you know, with things that they've drawn and made and presented in forms that are way more accessible.
Wow.
So... In short, yes, absolutely. I'm thinking about it, and I'm trying to, like, bridge that gap.
Because
I think you're right. Like, if you're looking at the art market as a whole, I'm playing in, like, the very shallowest bit. But even that still is, like, stratified.
Yeah.
And her $750 prints, Lanny's, are still kind of too much for some people.
Yeah.
And I do... There's a democratization in print that I think is super important and definitely drew me to it in the early days, like at SFAI. And that democratization is, you know, I don't want to lose that by going in this direction. So I am trying to find ways to kind of like strap.
Yeah, you're like trying to like meet the middle ground in a little bit where you're trying to like, well, I still have to make money at the end of the day.
Well,
but also like, but still keep the spirit of the, which is of the medium in some way too. It's like, which God knows any of us that's in this art world is always constantly trying to live that balance because, you know, that's our lives, you know.
Mm-hmm. And I think this is about like giving, you know, not just reproducing a piece that they've made smaller and cheaper and whatever. It's a, you know, they need to come in here and like spend some time and think about, you know, how to make something that fits into that kind of framework. But it's also like, you know, I
yeah. Well, because you all, yeah, and you seem like, and speaking to you, you seem to be the type, too, that constantly is thinking about, too, the cost of what it takes to make something, too. And because, like, as you mentioned, you want things to be right, and so it takes reprints, and that costs money to do reprints and the materials and whatever. So you're, like, constantly thinking about these things. So these are also important things to consider, which I think also, I think a lot of people, it's funny because I have friends that are not art people. For my undergrad, because I didn't go to an art school for undergrad. I went to a traditional four-year university. And a lot of my friends were accountants, lawyers, doctors, and whatever. And it always, and I'm the one friend that was the art guy. And the one thing they always say is, like, I can't believe that thing costs, like, $100,000. I'm like, do you understand how much it costs to bake, to buy paint, to then throw away paint, to buy paint again, the brushes, the canvases? All those things cost money. There's a reason why there's a price point. And they don't, and it's funny, like, people don't understand that that's sometimes just factored in.
Totally.
And then anything after that is extra about, like, based on popularity and whatever and the marketing and blah, blah, blah. But, like, but for the most part, people don't understand that, that, like, art materials cost a lot of money.
And time.
And time.
This is so time consuming.
Yeah.
You know, it, like, part of me is saying, like, oh, it's a choice to, like, slow everything down. But part of it's just, like, what it takes to do it right. Like, it's, it really is, you got to print stuff 2-3 times sometimes. You got to have people come in and make plates until they're happy and just burn through copper. There's, like, yeah, there's a lot of additional expenses. And I try not to let it, like, be the thing that rules the day, you know? Like, I run another business, basically, to pay for all this stuff.
Yeah.
And I, yeah, it's... If the goal was to get rich and famous, this would be a really stupid way to do it. That's
right. Yeah, you chose, and you also chose the medium that requires a lot of, like, equipment and, and expensive materials.
I'll be a video artist next time. But I think, yeah, it exists in the real world. It has to. It's not divorced from, like, you know, the market entirely.
Right.
But it is about just kind of, like, trying to play that game on your own terms.
Yeah.
It still has to be a little bit punk rock and accessible.
Right.
Like, that is still what this is. I don't want to have punk aesthetics. But I do, the spirit of it, you know, is like the Minutemen. It's we jam a Kano or whatever. It's like, how do the most with what you have and make the best possible product. And don't be sloppy just to be sloppy, of course. But, you know, like, if this is the best you can do, like, then it is enough too. So I'm kind of juggling all of these things.
Yeah.
You know, I want it to be, like, part of why I like this newer version is that, like, back to maybe your original question, is that, and I say this to all the artists when they come in, is this work is not supplementary material.
Yeah.
You need to be able to hang this next to the painting.
Yeah.
This is a part of the show. This is not a freebie at the front door.
Right.
This is...
It's an original.
It's an original, and it needs to carry the same weight.
Yeah.
You know, you need to be able to put it... You know, and Ryan really, like, God bless him, like, put that whole room in the back of part two with that series of etchings, and it held its own.
Yeah.
And I think it's something that maybe screen prints don't totally do. Not that you couldn't do it with them, but people just don't go to that if you're trying to, like, you know, put it next to an oil painting. And this is, like, a way to kind of, I don't know, to make something of substance.
Well, what's the biggest next project that you have? Like, is majority of the stuff you do, like, you aren't doing anything really based off of, I got a next big show coming that I'm working with an artist. Like, most of what you're doing is based off of whatever project you, like, it's artist specific, not really show specific, right?
Totally. It is all self-generated. And I think, you know, I do see, like, the bigger presses, they operate in that way too.
Yeah.
Like, what's his name? Henry Taylor just had a big show at Hazardworth. Mm-hmm. He was up at, they sent him to Paulson Fontaine to make some prints before, you know, and that just opened, I think, this weekend. So they do operate with that schedule, and I think, of course, like, I'm open to that. It's not where I'm at right now. Right now, I'm still kind of completely self-generated. I think Tyler Cross has, and his partner Kyle Lipka, who are also kind of like dead center in the nexus of this project. They have some shows coming up kind of throughout the new year, and I've been working on stuff with Tyler, so I think we'll kind of like see if we can find a way to sync those things up. But it kind of sort of, it seems like an artificial deadline. And I think ultimately what I learned with Sun Night was that it doesn't always translate to sales necessarily. So I wasn't sure what the benefit was all the time.
Yeah.
It was kind of like a way to like combine Instagram followings or something, if you can get all the mentions to line up, but it didn't necessarily benefit the prints, I don't think.
Yeah.
So like, and I don't know if the galleries always loved it either, because it was a way for people to get out the door for cheaper.
Yeah.
So there was kind of a little thing happening there that I sort of like it if it's like off on the side and it's something that they come and do and they're part of a larger project and they get to, you know, use this space for just something completely detached.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks for coming on, dude.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it was good. It was cool talking to you about all this stuff. No, seriously. And it was great hearing about, like, even your perspective and even, like, a little bit insider info about even what you think of in terms of running a print shop and a press and, you know, even the money parts. Because I think that's important. I think people don't fully understand the work and the thought that goes into these type of things and the stresses sometimes too. So I think it's important for people to hear that, because it isn't just you waking up one day and being like, yeah, I'm just gonna like slap some paint on a copper plate and call it a day.
Yeah.
So
well, I appreciate it. Thank you for asking the right question.
Yeah. Thanks.
That's it for today. Thanks for listening, and thanks again to Drew for coming on. For more information about 222 Press, be sure to visit his website at 222press.com or follow on Instagram at 222.press. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast wherever you listen to podcasts, and be sure to leave a rating if you can. You can also follow the podcast at ArtScenePC. And yeah, till next time, everyone.